welcome to the Making Theatre podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
At the virtual Making Theatre garden party, someone asked you what you do for a living. How do you answer that question?
I think what I say, I remember saying this to my grandfather, that I sit in the dark and make people look nice for a living. I sit behind a very large lighting desk, typing in long streams of numbers to make a lighting designer's vision come to life via the means of ones and zeros, which will confuse the person at a garden party, but essentially that's what I do.
Could you set the scene for us a little then, by way of introduction for those listeners who are not familiar with what it is that you do? Describe the setup in the auditorium for us.
Yes, so I sit behind a very large desk, and they're only getting larger.
I know, just sort of imagine ground control.
Yes, exactly. Me with like wraparound screens.
Like it's a giant computer kind of thing is what we're talking about.
Anywhere between like a metre and a half wide, with two very large screens in front of me and then banks of screens down the sides. I'm normally sat on a piece of wood, sat between two theatre seats. Most people see me from the bridge of my nose upwards because I'm quite small. We are completely in the dark and my face is then lit from all of the screens. I have a lighting designer to one side of me. We've got massive headsets on, whispering intently to each other and ignoring absolutely everybody else in the room, whilst I stare, but like 90% of the time, firmly at the stage, with my fingers tapping away on keys or touch screens, whilst the lighting designer talks almost nonstop to me for about 4 hours at a time, telling me the things that they want to see on stage. And then I translate that into key presses on a lighting desk and ultimately then record those into chunks of information, which then get built up to make the look of a show that is played back every night by an operator.
And can you explain a little bit about the complexity of a modern lighting rig and therefore why it's necessary to have someone skilled such as yourself programming it, controlling the rig?
Yeah. So when I started, which is, it's my 20 year anniversary this year of programming, we had lights that basically come on and go off. We deal with those by talking about their intensity. Zero would be off and 100% would be their sun intensity. And we talk about values in between. We had some lights that could change color that had a scroller, which meant that we had a set number of colors we could put in front of it. We had about 15 moving lights that could change position and change color and change intensity and potentially have a pattern or a size change within them. Now, every single rig that I work on, probably minimum 80% of the units has the capacity to be a completely different color, has the ability to change its position. And I then have to give each unit in the rig that information on what to do at any given point in the show.
That's a huge amount of data to handle, isn't it?
It is an awful lot of information to try and process, to try and hold in your head, and also to understand what the capabilities of what all of those things are and can be.
Yeah. And I guess lighting designer would be saying to you something like, can you grab those backlights, tilt them all downstage and line them up along the front edge, then trim them so they're not spilling out into the orchestra pit, and zoom in a little bit wider. Oh, no, that's a bit too wide, a little bit smaller. Oh, that one's catching the wall over there. Can you just trim that off that wall? And by the way, that's not really the right shade of blue. Can you make it 200? No, that's wrong. A little bit more sign. Yeah, that's great. Update that. And by the way, just see the person by the door there. Can you just shove a special on them quickly? Yeah. Just cut it inside that. And now we're getting to the next cue. And so it's...
Why did you do that so slowly, Bruno? That's normally twice the speed.
Well, exactly. I'm in front of it. It's kind of hard imagining what I might be saying. But yeah, so it's interesting because you're sort of the interface between the picture we're trying to create on stage and a whole bunch of technology and equipment, which are the tools we have to make that picture. Sometimes we're talking in numbers. Sometimes we're just talking broad brushstrokes, like grab those lights, shove them over there, make them a bit bigger. We're thinking about the picture in front of us, but also what happens in the next scene. Do we want those same lights in the same place? Do we want them preset? There's a huge amount of manipulation going on. It's fast-paced and exciting. Half your brain is looking at the stage in front of you. Half your brain is looking at Hollywood screens and numbers, which give you the information you need in order to deliver what the lighting design is asking for. Do you think that lighting designers could do without a programmer?
Some do.
God knows how.
I honestly don't know how, whilst also fending off a conversation from a choreographer or a costume designer who thinks that the pinks aren't pink enough, or the set designer who's worried about the fact that there shouldn't be light on that piece of scenery right now because it's not quite ready.
I feel like these days it's almost impossible, because with any large rig, the amount of information you've got to process on the programming end takes a huge amount of brain power, which means you then don't have the brain power to be looking at the stage, talking to the director, reading the script, talking to the stage manager and being in the room.
There's so much more to the role, isn't there, now than just lighting? It seems the diplomacy of it and the artistic discussion, all those things. It's very easy to hide behind the monitors, isn't it?
And that's one of my favourite places to be. And it's one of the main reasons that I don't want to be a designer, is that I find that fortress that I can make with all the monitors very protective.
what's clear is that in the heat of the moment, a lot of information comes from the lighting designer. And sometimes the data goes into the lighting desk very quickly, but it's necessary for you then to go back after the moment and make sure that it's all labeled correctly. That simplifies it rather. But the point being that if the show has a future life, you need to be able to pick up that show file. If it's not you, it might be somebody else, and for it to all make sense. And so there's a sort of constant updating and documentation taking place in the background the whole time, which is a huge part of what you do, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And it's trying to make sure that there's a set of instructions in a sensible order and is clear to somebody today and potentially a different person. But also to me, if I pick up that show in 10 years, I need to make sure that I've been kind to future me and I've labeled things in a way that will make sense if I haven't looked at this for 10 years.
So to clarify that a bit, the lights work in numbers, essentially. So you're putting a light in a position which has a pan and a tilt, and that has a bunch of numbers. What you do is you give those numbers a label generally. So instead of saying pan and tilt numbers, it's pointing at the chair. And instead of saying a color number, it's blue. And you know, zoom number might be wide or whatever. So you can look at the screen and then very quickly go, oh yeah, that light's pointing at the chair. And it's going to stay pointing at the chair until I tell it to point somewhere else. And putting all that information into the show file makes it easier to interpret what's going on in the show rather than just pages and pages of pure data. Can you also just explain quickly what the difference between a programmer and an operator is and just clarify how those roles work?
I will rarely see the show beyond the opening night, the press night. The operators will stay with it throughout the run of a show. They will run the rig checks to make sure that every light in the rig is performing as it should be at the beginning of each session. They will also be responsible for making sure that the follow spots are there and are happy, filling up fluid on smoke machines, all those things. And then whenever we open the house, they'll fit up the preset, make sure that it looks right. And then for the show, they have one button that they push when the DSM tells them, or on some shows, they might take those cues themselves. And then at the end of the night, they'll shut the rig down.
Yeah, so they're running the show and you're past the team that creates the show.
Yeah, ideally they'll operate in the first dress rehearsal so they can sit with me and see what the show should look like and ask any questions. And then I'll be with them on the first preview in the control space. But for the most part, they will be, on a lot of shows, the only lighting person with an eye on the stage.
But they have responsibility for preserving it.
Yeah. Was it Lauren who you spoke to about being a swing?
Yeah. Lauren Stroud, yeah.
Yeah.
If we've got a cut show, like there's a girl or two missing, there will be moments where lighting has to be removed because you don't want to have an empty spot on the stage. You want the audience to feel like they're getting the full production. We rip the game away if there's like six people in spots and there's one empty one. So the operator will make cut versions of the show file that have those elements removed that they can load in depending on whether it's a one-girl cut show, two-girl cut show.
Yeah.
So-and-so's off today.
That's spaghetti, isn't it?
It's absolute spaghetti.
But it absolutely has to happen.
Yeah, completely.
That's why the person left behind after Vic's gone has to be a skilled and talented and interested person engaged in the show. They have responsibility day to day to respond to what's happening on stage. Whereas what's happening on stage is instead of six girls lined up in spotlights along the front edge, you've only got four. They need to redo that cue to have four spotlights spread out into the right places. And, you know, It's really interesting. I mean, the process of keeping long-running shows alive, the amount of paddling that happens in the background to keep all that stuff happening by everyone involved.
I also provide documentation of what to do if there's a problem with the show. And I also, on most of my shows, we'll do the focus documentation where we will take photographs of every position of every light in the show and either a photo of what the cue should look like or potentially a video archive of the show. So they have various references of how things should look.
And just to sort of explain the scale of what you do, you talked about photographing every moving light position. Roughly how many would that be for a typical, say, a musical?
So I've just done Mrs. Doubtfire in the West End and I photoplotted that a couple of weeks ago, and that with all of the movers in all of the positions and all the generic focuses, that is 5,500 photographs, which is a lot to get through.
And I think that's a fairly normal number of photos for a large scale show. So that sort of gives an idea of the kind of the scale of the complexity of what modern lighting rigs need to achieve.
Yeah, the volume of information which we're dealing with is an awful lot. And partly it's what an audience expects when they pay their ticket price. We've taught them a visual language that they're now used to seeing, and that started in the late 80s, early 90s with the mega mix at the end of the show, and that became a popular thing, and then the mega mix started to drift further into the body of the piece. And Mr. Doubtfire is a pretty straight book musical, but there are big production numbers that audiences get excited about and performers enjoy doing and designers like lighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also ties into what we see on television, what we see in concerts, award shows and Strictly Come Dancing and all those sort of, you know, where used to much more spectacular lighting plots. So there's a certain expectation when you get to see a live show in a theatre as well. Yeah, something James and I really appreciate as lighting designers working in all kinds of different theatres and opera houses around the world is the huge creative freedom you get as a designer when you get to work with a fantastic programmer. It just takes the pressure off you thinking about the technical side of it and gives you opportunities to think purely about the creative side of it and have time to talk to the other members of the creative team. And you have two advantages. First of all, you have someone who's brilliant at pressing buttons, organizing the show file, and somehow getting out of the lighting designer's imagination something that actually happens on stage. And someone to kind of banter with and to share ideas with, and basically your sort of lighting friend to get you kind of through the tech. But which is super crucial. I wonder if it'd be interesting to talk about the criteria of what actually makes a good programmer.
Yes, please. I'd like to know. I'll start making notes.
Maybe we can work it out between us.
Yeah.
What do you think, James? What makes a good programmer?
I've got a little list here, sort of starting points anyway, we can discuss. But before we start that, I think that thing of having a lighting chum is, we were sort of laughing about that, but that is so important.
Yeah, it's like a little sidekick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Somebody to bounce stuff off and is sort of down in the hole with you is sort of the most important bit, isn't it? Understands exactly what you're going through.
Yeah, and has been there all the way along. And this is one of the problems that we face. If you go to one of the larger opera houses in Europe, they quite often have a rotating team of programmers. They're restricted by working hours, but for the LD, that's troublesome, isn't it, Bruno? You can't really get a momentum going, and you don't get that same sort of sense of collaboration. And as you say, you're not down in the hole with someone.
Exactly, shoveling away.
If I can't do the whole of the job, I bin myself off from the whole project. Because I think how quickly a tech moves.
Yeah.
Means that I would have lost an awful lot of the common information that everyone holds. And so a lot of it is quite useful to know the ideas that have been discarded as well as the things that you've gone forward with.
Yeah.
So that you're not volunteering information that's 2 days old or has already been tried several times. And I think it's also hard for the rest of the team and the new person coming in. And it's an awful lot of pressure to put on that person who's coming in going, right, here's a crash course in the shitstorm you're about to walk into.
Okay, so here's our criteria so far. The first point is, well, speedy typing and knowledge of the desk, essential.
Yeah, crucial.
The only way you can really get good enough is by doing it all the time, right? This is the thing that I think that a lot of producing houses in the UK struggle with, is that maybe they're only producing two or three shows a year, and that's just not enough really to get really good.
Yeah, and it's repetition, and it's not even about it becoming second nature. It's about you doing it unconsciously. Like, I type without looking at the keypad because I'm constantly doing that job. So the muscle memory is completely built up.
So you rely a lot on muscle memory. And if you don't keep practicing, it's a language, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like a language. If you don't use it, you lose it, to coin a phrase.
100%. Even when I'm not working, like, I'll be at home and I'll be doing stuff on my laptop and I'll be doing offline things just to keep my head in the game and also keep up with the things that change. Because if you're not programming on the desk for maybe 6 months at a time or even 3 months at a time, a new version of software will have come out.
Tied into the button pressing, it's not just about knowing where the buttons are and being able to press them without looking at them. It's actually about knowledge about the power of the desk and how it can achieve things.
Definitely.
Because I might say, oh, I'd like all those lights along the edge of the stage just to come on one by one, 5 seconds-ish spacing. And there's many different ways you could achieve that. And knowing the quick and efficient ways to deliver looks that can be manipulated and adjusted after the first version has been created is crucial. And that is about keeping up to date with the software.
Yeah, but also doing, like, I spend a lot of time, like, I spend between a day and a week prepping a show file. There's so much that happens before I even get into the venue that means that I'm able to react or keep up with what the lighting designer and then the show as a whole needs. So I have lots of different ways that I can access the information, versions of groupings of things or magic sheets. And if I'm trying to make that in the heat of the tech, we're already screwed. And it's getting better now, but that's certainly in the past, it's been underestimated how valuable that work is and how important it is. And it's difficult for production managers, producers to
understand that.
Yeah, to grasp that because it doesn't happen in front of them.
It's kind of invisible to them, isn't it?
Exactly. But if you don't do it, it becomes really apparent that we're in trouble.
And it's also your opportunity to learn what the lighting rig is. That prep time is your opportunity to look at the rig we've put together and talk to us about how we might use this, but also think about, I bet at some point in the tech, he's going to want to select all the lights at the end of those bars and turn them all on together and pan them downstage. Yeah. So you can preempt ways of selecting groups of light on the console and second guess what lighting designers might want. And that means you're coming into the tech on top of all the tools at your disposal.
I'd rather have done all of that stuff and have it ready to go and not need it than not have done it and just be sat there with a wall of expectation and me unable to meet that in the time available to me. And it means I can take a layer of complexity out of it for the lighting designer as well. But they don't have to say I need channels 42 through 51. They can just go, can I have that bank over there? And I know what they mean. And I've already given myself many different ways to connect all of that information. And they can just go, can I just have all of those things?
So that sort of covers our second point, knowledge of the rig and what the lights can do and where and what they can see. Do you have to keep up with the development of the units themselves as well?
I mean, I probably should, but give me the light and let me break is basically how I want to work it out. I'm not going to sit down and read the manual. But having said that, last week I was down one of the hire companies because I do Regent's Park every year, which is the UK's biggest open air theatre. And this year we've gone for an entirely LED rig and there's an awful lot of stuff that I didn't know. So I spent a whole day at White Light just trying to work out what I needed it to do. I think that's going to mean that we have more in our toolkit to hit the ground running on that show when we start in a couple of weeks. And it's nice sometimes if you can have a desk near the rehearsal room so that the lighting designer can be in rehearsals and you can maybe be doing your prep on site and they can pop in having just seen a number be rehearsed. And you can start to work out some of the visual language together, which puts you in a much stronger position before you even get into the theatre. So everyone's on the same page. And I really like going to rehearsals and seeing the shape of the work.
I've done that on all the big musicals I've worked on, had a lighting desk set up in the rehearsal room. In the rehearsal room building, you have a little corner somewhere where you can do the advanced prep work with a programmer and dip in and out of rehearsals. And it also means the programmer can come and see run-throughs. It's really, really helpful. And also makes you less invisible, going back to the whole point of proving what you do before you appear on site. Occasionally have a producer looking over your shoulder while you're doing prep work because the desk happens to be in the room outside the rehearsal space. It's quite interesting because they see you just been crunching numbers for 10 hours.
Yeah, and people have an idea of who you are.
Yeah, it's important.
Next point is, I think, the thing that is rare, which is mind reading skills.
Oh, you've noticed.
Which is anticipation, I guess. So like you can look at a rig and know what the intention is behind some of the choices the LD's made, but also it's linked to that next point that we've got there as well, which is the ability to tune into the LD's taste, I think, is to be able to look at what we're doing and make decisions and offer things.
That's hard to do straight out of the blocks. If you haven't worked with an item designer before, I normally will either have worked with them or have at least seen some of their work, or it's rare that I would know nothing about the designer or their style.
Yeah, so you make offers and some of them are taken and some of them are rejected. And as the process continues, you start to get more of a sense of what's appropriate for that particular production. But we've called it shorthand in the past for other creative relationships, I think. And that's essentially what we're talking about here, isn't it? As you get to know each other, you start to figure out each other's taste and what the likely appropriate solution for any given moment is.
Yeah, common vocabulary, but also that thing knowing like the lift of a shoulder in a lighting zone, if you see them get tense or if you see somebody approach them, you're like, oh, this might be a tricky conversation. Being sensitive to all of that, and it's like it's the non-verbal stuff as well as the verbal stuff.
Our next point is knowing how to read the room, because it's definitely a skill, knowing when to offer suggestions and when to keep quiet.
In terms of my understanding of the political wranglings in the room and the delicate relationships that are going on, I can't judge any of that if I'm in a control room or I'm away from.
No,
I mean, I'm a nosy person. I like the gossip. I want to be right in the middle of it. I mean, for me, I want to be right by the lighting designer.
So yeah, we've established a friend, an ally, and a sidekick is really important. You have to be creative, right? And I think this is where we get into expectation, what people expect to be doing in the job, because I've encountered a lot of excellent programmers, but what they don't expect to be doing is contributing ideas and having an opinion almost. I don't know if that's your experience too, Bruno. I sort of feel like that's to do with just the approach to a job and the philosophy.
I think there's different ways of working. And I think a lot of that's also to do with time. When you have an extended tech on a musical or something like that, and there's actually time to have a bit of a conversation about things. But sometimes, especially in the sort of high pressure of trying to get an opera on, then you're relying on the local programmers more for their knowledge of the rig, because often it's the same rig that they use for every single show.
Yeah.
So you're relying on their knowledge of that more than, oh, is that really the blue you want to go for, kind of thing. So you're sort of using them for their technical knowledge, perhaps a little bit more than to bounce creative ideas about. But it always works best when the programmer's personality is one that's open to sort of conversation, chipping in, sort of helping with the whole thing. Do you enjoy that role too, sort of having creative input?
I love it. It's my favorite bit about it. I started programming in a building where you'd program one show a year and everyone would get a go at being on the desk because it wasn't so complicated and it basically was data entry. All you had to do was type in the numbers. Yeah. There was no additional artistic qualities that required from the job. When the lighting rig started to become more complicated, when moving lights started to be more typical in rigs, it became more difficult to program because you were having to make some artistic decisions. You were having to interpret sometimes not entirely clear instructions from a lighting designer, and that required more of an artistic eye or more of a knowledge of the vocab that they were using that you would necessarily have had to have in the past. I don't really understand 100% or care what the desk is doing underneath the hood. That bit doesn't excite me so much. There are programmers who really revel in that, and that isn't me. What I really enjoy is the magic bit where the designer describes what they want to see on stage and I'm able to make that happen.
Mm.
Peter Mumford, who I have worked with a lot in the past, referred to me as an editor. When I've worked with people for a long time, I know the style in which they liked and I might be able to help and make suggestions. So I'm able to say, maybe we could do this, or maybe a bit less of that, or this could do this color. And I'm not precious about that. If none of that stuff is used in the show, it doesn't really make any difference to me because I'm constantly generating stuff with the lighting designer. I never wanted to be a lighting designer and I tried it once and it really wasn't for me. And this is a very protected way of me flexing that muscle with entirely plausible deniability. Sometimes as it looks rubbish and I can go, yes, I know. I tried to make them not do it, but they wouldn't listen.
Yeah, I think it's such a lovely thing. And I think it's such a supportive thing. I think when you've got a programmer who you've built up a good relationship with and a good sort of creative trust with, sometimes you need someone to tell you, Bruno, that's just a bit rubbish. Come on. Really? You're going to do that? That question sometimes makes you go, actually, no, that's a terrible idea. And sometimes it makes you double down and go, no, I actually am going to do that. It's actually what I need to do for this moment.
Yeah.
But also sometimes you're staring at the stage, you had a whole bunch of notes from the director and your mind has just gone blank. And then you just need someone to turn the light on and then it starts. And you go, oh, yeah. No, not that light, Vic. This light. And then suddenly you're off. And it's such a great and thrilling collaboration when you're in the heat of it. Having that combination of brains looking at the same problem from slightly different perspectives.
I think a programmer is a lonely job. A lighting designer job is far lonelier, I think, because so much of your work is done with everybody around whilst you're making mistakes for the first time and everyone has an opinion. And in my experience, mostly people want to come up and tell you the thing that they didn't like rather than celebrate the things that they have enjoyed at your work. They just want to get, didn't love that. Not really a big fan of red. Okay, I'm 50% of the show in red. I'll figure that out. Thank you. And being able to run interference with that or be able to have an ear on those conversations that are happening and start prepping stuff that might be useful or every now and again go, no, there's a desk problem. I'm really sorry. We just need to take a minute, which might give everyone a moment to just reset a little bit and have a moment to think, particularly like when a director says, I love what you're doing. This is great, but I'd love to see something that we've not seen on this stage all day.
Yeah.
Great. And I've just done 15 things that we've not seen on this stage all day. Now you want a 16th. I don't think I've got a 16th in me.
Yeah.
And there were things that I do as a programmer to try, like as a human being, to try and dispel those kind of tensions in the room. Also to be able to be a sounding board if somebody's being difficult, be able to support the lighting designer because we're on comms in our own little secret world, so nobody else can hear the conversations that we're having. You can do a little bit of kind of mini cheerleading to try and get a lighting designer back to the point of confidence that's been eroded over the space of a day.
We're talking with Lucy Carter about that as well, about how intimate those conversations are. You're also sat in a row, not that close to each other, but you've all got these headsets on and you can basically talk quietly into each other's ears while everything else is kind of happening around you. It's a magical thing.
Do you guys find that you are conscious going into an environment where you know you're not going to have someone who is as responsive, that you restrict what you're going to do?
Yes, totally. And I absolutely curtail my ambition to the show if I know I haven't got a programmer who can touch type, for example. You can quickly work out if someone's looking for the buttons, then obviously they're less experienced, which means the pace at which you can adjust things live while the rehearsal's happening in front of you is hugely reduced.
Mm.
So therefore, I'm immediately discounting certain ideas, rethinking how many cues I can get done in a certain amount of time. You sort of do it subconsciously. You don't really think about it. But you just go, okay, I can't achieve that. That won't get done. We can probably do that, but we're going to have to do it a week on Saturday when we get that 4-hour lighting call in the morning.
Yeah.
You then cut to what the most important things are. Sometimes simplification is a good thing, but it's a bit frustrating when you can't move at the pace you want to. Talking to some directors, they're increasingly aware when a program is holding things up, especially if they've experienced different speeds of tech and different speeds of making lighting in shows. When you're working with someone super in tune with the process and super quick, then you can bang through so much more stuff and you can try things, adjust it and update it while everything's running in front of you.
I think in general, programmers are now being brought up at the parameters meeting that happens very early on in the process of making a show, that this is one of the non-negotiable things. If you want this show, I've heard your ideas. The only way we can make this happen is if we have this person come in, and that's an extra bit in your budget, but it is worth every single penny because it means that we suddenly have the ability to achieve everything that you're talking about.
Yeah, that pretty much covers our list, doesn't it?
I think so.
Of our criteria of a good programmer. I hope everybody followed that.
The pushing of the buttons in the right order and the understanding of the desk is a percentage of it. Quite a lot of it is a personality game. I thought when I started, I would be the perfect programmer for every lighting designer. And that is so far from the truth.
Well, we're all different. I think it's depending on the personality. I like to have someone sitting next to me that I want to sit next to.
I could put the finest programmer in the world together with the finest light designer in the world. And if they don't get on, or they don't have the same temperament, or there's something that niggles you about that person, if you're sat with them in the dark, in that little kind of conned love cave together, those things get amplified.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is, and like there's no shame in that on either side. The shame is if you keep going back and repeating this, that's the sign of madness, isn't it? Doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome.
Bruno, do you want to talk about big musicals and concerts? Because you're a much better place to ask questions about this than I am.
I think there's a different aspect of programming when you're doing music concerts. A lot of what the lighting is being asked to do is react directly to the music rather than to the performances themselves and create big visual spectacle. The kind of thing everyone's seen when they watch pretty much any live concert these days. You've got strobes and moving lights moving through the air and beams in the haze. And you're creating rock and roll lighting looks. Everyone knows what that means. There's two different ways that concerts and these musical looks are operated. One of which is probably now the most common is using timecode. Everyone's seen the clapperboard at the beginning of filming with numbers, digital numbers moving across it. And that's basically timecode. It's a system developed to make sure that all the camera shots are in sync. We use that to make sure the lighting cues are in sync. And so long as the musicians play at the same tempo and they tend to have a click track in their ear to make sure they do, then we can program the lights to be in sync with this timecode. Vic, do you want to talk about timecode programming and what that means?
So timecode has become much more prevalent in recent years. So the musicians will have a click track in their ear, and there will normally be a guide track that plays underneath, only because orchestras and musicals are getting smaller and smaller, and we still need them to sound as if there's 15 people downstairs, even if there's four. So there will be a bed that plays under most tracks, and we can listen into that. So the video department, the lighting department, the sound department, and the music department all have a feed. If you ever hear it, it is like the modem from dial-up internet back in the 90s, but at about 4,000 decibels. It is so loud and screechy, it's horrendous. Oh my God, it's horrific.
But it's a box. It's a box is generating this, right?
Yes, there's normally a box down in the pit. So it's normally the MD who's in charge of that. And we all then get a feed out to it, and it can come to the lighting desk, to the sound desk. It'll also go to video quite often.
And the idea is that everybody can take an automatic cue at the same moment.
So we can all, we can basically hook on to bits of the time code, particularly in large production numbers and concerts with bands. The audience now expect, because we've seen it in concert touring and on TV, and it's more and more prevalent in theatre, they expect to see accents with the music, all of the bangs, the flashes, the strobes, the buttons. Yeah. And the moment it's slightly off, it takes really you off. Out of the
really
thing
does,
that you're watching.
Yeah. It ties the whole room together, doesn't it? And it puts real emphasis on everyone communicating what they're doing, because you can't sort of work in isolation.
Certainly on the things like the big shows I've done and some of the big music things, we have someone whose job is basically managing the time code and making sure that everyone knows what's going on, because it has huge effects on everyone if it's out of sync.
Yeah, because when it works, it's brilliant. And when it doesn't work, everything goes
wrong.
Sit hell in a handcar.
And this is my big problem with timecodes, in that it's a linear thing. You know, it doesn't change tempo. The music changes tempo. It's just this constant thing that you're hanging cue points onto. So if the music speeds up and the timecode doesn't, then all the cues will be out of sync.
That's quite a big thing for a band, isn't it? If you're tied into a tempo, there's no response to an audience. Like if you go and see a band that's not on time code and there's a lot of energy in the room, it feeds back the band and they might speed up or slow down accordingly. If you're in time code, none of that can happen.
What time code gives you is incredible precision in that you can go through and make a light flash with every single drum hit by breaking it down beat by beat. And the other thing that's really important is it means you can sync with video content as well. And video content is increasingly rhythmic as well. So if you can commit to putting the track on time code, you can deliver a visually spectacular show.
Yeah.
The disadvantage of time code is that there's no musical freedom. You can't stretch out a bar a little bit longer. You can't repeat a chorus again. There's certain tricks and balances the way you can adjust your programming for those chunks. But generally, you're locked in. And some bands find that really difficult. The band I work with a lot programmed a whole show on time code for the first part of their tour. And they found it so restrictive musically that we went back into rehearsals and unpicked the whole thing. And then the lights are operating in a very different way. The person operating the lights isn't just pressing go when they're told to by a stage manager or by following a script. They're actually playing the lighting disc like a musical instrument. Things like that tour, which is the Sigur Rós tour that I did originally with Matt Dorr, is that when he toured it, he was absolutely operating the show live every night.
But you absolutely need somebody who is really musically in tune with what's happening on stage. It's interesting with the Sigur Rós in that, actually suddenly you want the human element back to it, which means that they as a group can react and can be part of the common experience that everyone is having in the room.
Let's come back into the theatre world because we've sort of had a little foray into rock and roll. Do you like it when Eddies know how the desk works?
That's a leading question, isn't it? Yes and no. I don't mind it when they know how the desk works. I do mind it when they want to tell me how to do my job. Like there's lighting designers who I work with who do not care how the computer thing works. They just want me to make the thing that's been in their head since rehearsal started happen on stage. And every now and again, they'll say to me, why didn't that work? And I'll start explaining and I'm about halfway through a sentence. They go, actually, do you know what? I don't care. Just make it better. It becomes tricky if people have a little working knowledge of the desk and they think that sometimes like quoting syntax, which might be a few years out of date, can get in your head and you can start typing the wrong things. And it doesn't faze me unless they're in the desk a little bit too much.
But what about if, taking myself as an example, I like to have a touch screen on my desk with a color picker in a large format. So rather than talking a little bit more blue, a little bit more red, you could just move your finger around and paint, essentially, which is one of the things that I do like about LED rigs these days, is it sort of adds a little bit of painting back into it. But what I enjoy, which I guess makes your life more complicated, is being able to look at a costume, say, and move the color picker around to work with that particular costume at that particular moment. And then I ask the programmer to save that palette. But that's actually the limit of my involvement with the actual desk itself. Would you rather just do the palettes yourself?
No, well, particularly like with like a Muster 3, for example, a new ETC profile, that's an 8-color mix in terms of the LED array inside of it. Who's got time to talk about a little bit less deep red, a little bit more lime? It makes everybody's life easier. And it also, as you say, it's nice to have that element where you get a little bit of control back. The issue with, about making the color, the issue is how we describe that color. Like on Book of Mormon or something, there's 15 different things called open white. And they are all different. My only problem as a programmer is knowing what to call them. So like color pick is fine. I don't mind people labeling their own cues or telling me where to, what effects this should be called, but it does mean that I start to switch off. If you want to take care of that bit of the information, that's fine. But my brain is used to processing it in this particular order, and therefore my little trick, the mnemonic or whatever it is corrupted. And that means I'm not going to be as valuable to you at that stage in recalling that information with speed, I think.
I know what you mean. I think it's weird. If you label something yourself, you can't remember what it is because you typed it in. Your brain had to make the decision about what that was going to be called. If someone else tells you what to type, it becomes part of the automatic typing process rather than something you thought about, which means you are probably less likely to recall it.
Definitely. Listen, I think it is now finally time for the quick fire round.
James's favourite bit.
It is. I think you can start, James. Go.
Victoria Brennan, are you a night owl or an early riser?
Oh, I think I've become both. Like I'm a night owl because I love it, but during the pandemic, I started waking up early and I wasn't drinking. So it is possible I might also be an early riser now as well. But my heart is as a night owl, definitely.
What's your favourite tool?
Haze, I think, probably. Right. Like, it's only interesting if it hits something. I don't know how I'd ever do a musical without Haze, because that means that all of the work that I'm really diligently doing to make things wang about and change colour is visible. So yeah, I love Haze, I think.
Do you have a favourite colour?
In terms of, like, the world, yellow is my favourite colour because I think it's brilliant. But in terms of light, no, not really. I mean, I like tungsten, but is that a colour?
Kind of yellowish white.
Or was that just a feeling?
It's a feeling. I think it's
but it's the quantity of the tungsten, not just...
I know. I think it's increasingly a feeling for us these days.
Increasingly, it's a memory.
It's a memory. Yeah.
A lovely memory that we all share. But let's not dwell on that too long.
No.
What's your favourite bit of the process?
Probably tech, but that's just because that's what I'm in 90% of the time. But I love it. I love everybody being together, making the same thing. When I went freelance, I really missed the everyday being part of the team, people who make a show and like get to know each other. Mm. And every now and again, I do still miss that. But the intensity, the adrenaline, the lack of lunch breaks, everything about tech, I just think is magical. The fact that on a Sunday, you have a bare stage and potentially by a Thursday, there's a whole world created. I just think that is the most fabulous thing. And I feel very, very privileged to still be able to do that.
I think we both agree with that. production desk must-haves. If you had a rider, like a rock star, what would be on it?
Oh, you said quick fire. I've got like a tight 15 about this.
All right, you can have one. What's top of the list?
It's a flat surface with a chair and a proper desk at the right height. It's comfort.
I think we've got enough people who say that to almost form a petition now to petition the government to make it legal.
Comfort and ergonomics. Yeah.
I think it should be possible. And with people building new theatres, it just seems daft to me that that isn't part of, and I know it's complicated because potentially in some venues, they're not in a tech for 10 years, but I'm in one every single
It's just a question
week.
Of will. It just needs to be done.
Maybe we need to start a making this podcast campaign and get everyone to send in photos.
Oh yeah,
everyone to send in photos of their ridiculous production desk setups and how long we've had to sit there.
That's a really good idea. We should do that.
Name a show that was an influence on you.
So there's probably two Josephs and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat at the Palladium in the early 90s, which I went to see several times. And also a show called The Hunting of the Snark, which lasted about 10 and a half minutes at the West End. But my dad basically used to use the West End as childcare when my mum used to go back to Dublin for weekends. So dad was taking us to a matinee and an evening show. So I saw quite a lot as a kid.
Wow.
And The Hunting of the Snark sticks with me. I was very lucky to go and see lots of like a wide variety of stuff.
Yeah.
But what do you need to be better at?
I genuinely do sit after every show and try and figure out ways to improve. And sometimes it's about trying to be better for that particular lighting designer. Sometimes it's about being less hard on myself.
It's interesting, isn't it, actually? If you work in a more traditional job in an office or even probably in a theatre building, you do get appraisals and feedbacks. And there's a structure of human resources or management to help you progress. And I think as freelancers, we all just wing it ourselves.
I think with Demi Spur, about a year ago, I'd said yes to too many things and things had moved their dates around after the pandemic. And there was a really difficult moment where everything had piled up and I couldn't see a way out of it. So I was struggling. I mentioned it to Zoe because we were working on a show at the time. We'd had a problem with something within the show and I thought that was my fault. And we've had a big conversation about it. And she said to me, you know, sometimes you can just say no. And I said, no, I don't think I do know that. She said, we will come back and we'll ask again. If people want to work with you, they'll keep asking. If you feel like you can't do that job for whatever reason, just say no. And that was one of the most valuable conversations I think I've ever had. And very young, but very wise. And she's like, it will just be better for everybody. It'll be better for the experience that the light designer has.
This is a major thing for every freelancer, isn't it? Learning that lesson is a big part of work-life balance for a start.
Yeah. But it was an incredible freedom.
Right. Yeah. I think it was for me too when I learned that lesson. But it's also about you're in it for the long game. And if you take on too much, you can't sustain it at a personal level, but also professionally, you just end up doing a dodgy job. And that, in the end, has a much more detrimental effect on your career than potentially letting someone else in. I mean, that's the main fear, isn't it? If you don't say yes this time, someone else will, and they'll get the job and they'll be asked in the future and you'll never get a look in again. Of course, you know, it doesn't really work that way, actually.
No.
It doesn't. But,
also, potentially, if that does happen, maybe that's not the person I want to work with. Maybe that that shows me something about our relationship. But
well, it's around comes around as well. I mean, it's yeah. just about who's available. And in the future, that person won't be available and, you know, I am. So yeah. I get the job again. And it's, but yeah, it's just the way that it goes. But crucially, taking on too much is just as, is much worse, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sure we all thought about this a lot during the pandemic, but now we're hopefully past that. What job would you do now if your profession went away?
And the answer, I think, is picture framer.
Why not?
Because I think it's an absolute racket, because you can make a bloody fortune and it's wood and glass and a little bit of cardboard, maybe. But it's really nice, and like it's a very satisfying thing to do. And I remember James saying, that's also a little bit what you do as a programmer, is you frame the lighting designer's pictures. And I thought that that was such a lovely metaphor for what I do. I'm just finding another weird way to do it. Or the other option is that, and I think about it quite often, and it's still in theatre, but maybe being a producer.
Mm. Yeah.
But,
I could see that.
So watch this space.
Yeah. Okay, we will. Finally, pudding or cheese?
Pudding all the way. Yeah, I love cheese, but give me a bit of eating mess or some cakes and I'd be in heaven.
Very good, Vic. The Making Theatre bar has just opened. It's early for the bar to open, but we have flexibility to open any time we want. So it's James's round. What can he get you?
Again?
Yeah, the problem is, James, I keep ending up being the person getting to say the line, so therefore you're buying the drinks, so it works out really well.
What would I like to drink? I'd probably like a nice IPA.
The pint?
Thing, but I don't... Yeah, well, that may be a vlog, actually.
It is early.
It's early, it is, yeah. Well.
Yeah. How do you spot a nice IPA from the label? This is always my challenge at bars, it says.
Well, I mean, I'm looking on the label and I'm seeing if it's the low 4% to begin with. And then I'm asking for a taste. I'm always asking for a taste.
Ask for a taste.
If I don't like the taste, it's going back. And then I'll maybe have an alcohol-free situation if there isn't a nice IPA.
And that situation is improving, isn't it? Really,
oh, it's so good. Yeah,
can get some nice ones now, or at least...
And you can get them on draft, which is even better.
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I've had a lovely time.
Good.
The Making Theatre podcast is compiled, produced and edited by Bruno Poet and myself, James Farncombe. As ever, if you have any questions, comments or even ideas for future episodes, you can contact us on Instagram or Twitter at Making Theatre FM, or if you prefer, by email on makingtheatrepodcast@gmail.com. We are doing this for fun, and also hopefully to contribute to a broader awareness of everyone's role in the industry. So we do all the hard work, all you have to do is spread the word and take a moment to leave us a glowing review on your favourite podcast platform. Seems like a pretty good deal to me, and we'd be very grateful. Until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye.